If you're enjoying this podcast, make sure to check out another new podcast from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's called Good Weekend Talks, and each week you can listen to a full read-through of its most popular cover stories, from inside Scott Morrison's Pentecostal church to the Spanish flu, were we ready for another pandemic? You can listen to the definitive stories that matter to Australians. So after this episode, go and search Good Weekend Talks. From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is The Televisionaries. Today we're cooking up a rating storm with a reheated MasterChef, looking at how the essentials of food, clothing, shelter and love underpin our viewing habits, and we're in a high-purchase cabin cruiser on the canals of Sydney's Sylvania waters having a few drinks with Australia's first family of reality TV. I'm Louise Rugendyke and welcome to The Televisionaries. Here with me today from the Herald and The Age newsrooms, guide and Green Guide columnist and reviewer Debbie Enker, and calling in from our LA studio is our culture editor-at-large Michael Odato. Hello.
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 How are you both?
Good, really good.
Today we're looking at MasterChef, Channel 10's reality cooking competition that has captured the attention of a nation in lockdown. The first episode of its 12th season aired last week to an extraordinary national audience of 1.56 million people. That's up from last year's debut audience of 905,000. But this year, it's not just about the food. We have three new judges, former winner Andy Allen, food writer Melissa Leong, and chef Jock Zonfrillo, and a cast of 24 former contestants, plus an early appearance by celebrity chef Gordon Ramsay, all cushioning what could have been a bumpy landing in the long-running show's reboot. But is it just a case of a literal captive audience, or has MasterChef recaptured the magic that led it to become one of the most watched shows on Australian TV of all time? Before we jump in, let's have a listen to this clip where judges Jock Zonfrillo and Andy Allen challenged the cast of returning all-stars.
So, first challenge. We want you to cook us a dish that is worthy of winning the competition. So right now on day one, you need to play your A game as if this was the finale.
Whoever cooks the best dish today, I think you guys know what I'm talking about, gets this. An immunity pin. Or should I say, the immunity pin.
Dun-dun. Debbie, does MasterChef have all the right ingredients for reality TV?
MasterChef has always been one of my very favourite reality TV shows. I've got three at the top of my list, MasterChef, The Block and Survivor, and I've always had a very big soft spot for MasterChef, I guess because I'm interested in cooking and eating more than I am perhaps in renovating or being on an island and trying to make fire. But the foods always look great and there's always been a real warmth about this show. And I think one of the things that hasn't changed over 12 seasons and with the arrival of the new judges is that it still has that warmth about it, which I think, you know, to use a MasterChef term, that's its hero ingredient.
Michael, is MasterChef proof that no star is bigger than the TV show they are on?
This came up many years ago in an interview on Sunrise where about Kate Ritchie's departure from Home and Away. And essentially the question was, is this the biggest loss in the show's history? And the answer I gave then, which I firmly believe, is no actor's ever bigger than a show, no show is ever bigger than a network. It's a kind of natural order of things in the unnatural world of television. And I think that this is a show where food is totally number one on the call sheet.
But, Michael, don't you think you can really stuff it up with bad casting?
You can, but I think the buffer here is, I think, the returning contestant block. So, for example, you don't need these three. And to be fair, look, Jock, Melissa and Andy, they're sort of calmly coming out of the gate here. I don't think they're sort of trying to be anything spectacular. Mm. And I think having this returning contestant bank in this season essentially means that all of a sudden Poe's story is kind of a really potent story. I think there's a whole bunch of stories going on within the ranks of the contestants. The stakes are slightly higher. You absolutely can stuff up casting. I don't think they have here. I think it becomes more a case of, is there a wrenching loss when someone goes? And I think the truth is, so long as you don't stuff up the casting, the brand itself will hold the show together.
Yeah, and I think it allowed it to reboot. As with the reboot of the new judges, it gave them a woman judge in Melissa, which I think was incredibly important because Gary George and Matt, even though they were great, we had them for 12 seasons, it was a very blokey scenario. And the only sort of women judges they had were the occasional guests like Nigella Lawson to come in. And I think also having Melissa Leon, a food writer with an Asian background, also plays to the show's diverse strengths because I think it is one of the most effortlessly sort of diverse shows on Australian TV.
I think it also talks to us kind of culturally in the sense that, I mean, I quite delight living in America where Thai food is still something of an obscurity. I quite always delight in telling Americans that in Australia, I think when they say, what's Australia's national cuisine? I inevitably say Thai because it's, to my eye, it's the only guaranteed restaurant on every street corner in every neighbourhood in Australia. I feel like Thai kind of became Australia's national cuisine. So I think Australia actually has a great appetite for Asian food. And even just watching these MasterChef episodes, I mean, you know, there's one moment where a pork chop is cooked. And I remember I was watching it thinking, a pork chop? Like, my God, how uninteresting. I mean, of course, ironically, the pork chop, in fact, was scored incredibly well. And the guy making it, of course, was sent straight upstairs. But in a kitchen where all of that incredibly interesting Asian and international cuisine is being made, you've got to be a brave man to try and cook a pork chop.
I think one of the other great things about this season too, I think Jock Zomfilo has said he really wants to push native and indigenous ingredients to the fore. So that's another sort of, I suppose, bow to the MasterChef sort of diversity angle. It's just so good with MasterChef that's natural. It doesn't feel forced.
There is a sense about it where you're seeing an Australia that you never see, say, when you look at our soaps, if you look at Home and Away or Neighbours. But what you see here is fantastic Middle Eastern food, fantastic South American food, great Vietnamese and Thai food, and it blends perfectly into the format. Like, it just fits and it looks like the Australia most of us know from the suburbs we live in.
I think also there's a and I think this is not just about MasterChef or about television. In the corporate world, there's a great discussion about the power of authenticity in branding. You know, it's the reason certain things do incredibly well and other things don't. And I think that it's what puts MasterChef on the right side of the dividing line. There is something sort of very pure and very intellectual about this show. It's not, it's more scientific than emotional. If you look at something like My Kitchen Rules, there's sort of so much of it is driven by people arguing in the kitchen, and it's sort of that it sort of it tries to create for itself a sort of interpersonal narrative where it could be a cooking show, but the same argument could be happening on a dating show or a home renovation show. So that pushes other shows into a sort of a generic space, and it keeps MasterChef in this incredibly authentic space where the cooking is the star in lots of ways, and all the pressure situations are born out of things like, will the cake be cooked in time? Will the cake be too hot to be iced? Will that, you know, all these odd things that you wouldn't think, you know, were strong enough to kind of drive narrative tension in a reality show. But actually here there's great potency about this.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. I think the one things I really like about the fact the returning contestants is they're not dwelling on their backstories and the emotion. They just used to do the same thing every year. They try and push someone to cry as they described a dish, and you're like, oh, my God, just present a cheesecake. I don't need to know that your grandmother died, your mother died, in order for you to put this dish up for testing. Like, just, I don't need it. I want to know about the food. I want to know how stressful it was to cook. I'm very thankful that this year they seem to be doing that a little bit more.
I kind of like the backstory.
Oh,
I'm missing a bit of it. I don't want everyone in tears about dedicating this dish to their much beloved and no longer with us grandparent. But I do like that thing of getting a bit of a sense of the story of people that has brought them to this place. Like, normally it was, you know, I've been working in the finance industry, but I've always really loved cooking and I wanted to see if I could maybe have a shot at doing well at it, because my real dream is to open a cafe with home, you know, rustic home cooking with a Spanish influence. I kind of liked all of that stuff. And on the basis of what we've seen so far, certainly they don't need to do that as much. And those little filmed segments of people talking about what's happened in their lives have been really fleeting. Mm.
I would say for this season particularly, I'm loving the returning contestant factor. I feel like there's a sort of, there's a hero's narrative here. And I think that a lot of that for the audience, someone like Poe, you know, is sort of, because she was season one of MasterChef, because she wasn't just a contestant, she was the runner-up. So Julie Goodwin won that season. Both of them actually, of course, went on to great success. But there's something about the idea that Poe has a score to settle with this show. And I feel like if you're somebody who's watched the show from the beginning, you're kind of invested in that score as well. And I think that there's sort of it's strange how these, you know, the sort of the structural elements of the show might seem ridiculous. The idea that, okay, she's going to cook a lychee strawberry chiffon cake, great. But how the pressure of that, the idea that she's got 90 minutes to do it, it normally takes 3 hours. Darling of all that, the idea, there's so much bravura in that score settling. It's like it's a Western in lots of ways. I feel like, you know, there's a bunch of gunslingers in a kitchen and I feel like for me emotionally, I'm invested in her. I want her to win. I enjoy that pressure. I want to see her kind of punch her way through to the next round, because there's a sort of there's a moment in history where she was denied something and she's returned to claim the prize. I think that stuff is amazing. That's very, and in a way that becomes the emotional narrative. I don't need to hear about my grandmother's recipe. I'm there because the emotional stakes are actually incredibly high.
Yeah.
I think it also helps that she's got a smile that lights up a room.
Yes.
She's so fabulous on camera, irresistible. You just kind of can't help barracking for her. And it was an incredibly gutsy move to, in a time trial, pick something that was going to take the entire amount of time to produce. It was kind of the amount of tension that created in watching the episode up until the point that she actually managed to serve it up and it looked spectacular was extraordinary. If you'd scripted it, you couldn't have scripted it better.
I mean, I think for me too, there are very few reality shows that you could still call to mind really easily, but the final episode of the first season of MasterChef with Julie and Poe, you know, when Julie won and the confetti came down, and I think, remember seeing Manu crying because Julie's husband and boys came in. I hadn't seen anything like it on TV before, because I think MasterChef was the first big reality show I really invested it in, like this, you know, huge cooking, I don't use the word journey, but I'm going to. And it was just great. And I don't think any reality show has eclipsed that finale ever.
I think that finale that you talked about had something like 3 million viewers.
Yeah.
Extraordinary figures that it notched up. It really kind of changed television at night in Australia, I think. That primetime block was viewed very differently from the time of MasterChef's early success.
Yeah, that's quite common now for all the reality shows to have be on sort of 4 to 5 nights a week. And you're right, the first season of MasterChef, I think, was rated 3.5 million. And it was the second season, which featured Adam Lior and Callum, rated more, it was 4 million. And they're still both in the top 10 of Australia's top rating TV shows, sort of beaten by Royal Weddings, Australian Open and various football shows. But they're still up there as, you know, extraordinary high watermarks in the Australian TV history. And the popularity of MasterChef brings us to our big question of the day, which is the enduring appeal of reality TV and why we still watch it. All of Australia's free-to-air networks have a hand in it, from the ratings and controversy juggernaut that is Nine's Married at First Sight to Seven's My Kitchen Rules and this year's reboot of Big Brother. Ten has MasterChef and the various Bachelors plus Survivor, while ABC and SBS dabble occasionally in the reality pool with shows such as Back in Time for Dinner and Struggle Street. Even Netflix has muscled its way in with dating shows Love is Blind and Too Hot to Handle. So is it voyeurism, boredom, or a little bit of both that keeps us tuning in? Michael, why do we like to watch?
I've always stuck by the food, clothing, and shelter kind of line when it comes to this question, which is that those three things, food, clothing, and shelter, we would take to be very central to our existence. And these shows speak to that. Obviously, our love of food, television talks about our need and our love of food. Desire for good shelter, for shelter in practical terms, talks to our desire, our interest in home renovation. I mean, just even something as cynical as our obsession with the property market. Clothing is a little funkier because in television terms, you know, we're not talking about shows. Project Runway and Making the Cut are not as mainstream as you might say MasterChef is in the food space or The Block is in the shelter space. These are staples of our existence. They are kind of a central part of what drives us, and they certainly drive our appetite and our voyeurism, really, because this is as much about learning and understanding as it is as much about peeping. And really what we want to do is see other people's bad clothes, we want to see other people's terrible recipes, and we want to see what other people's disastrous bathroom renovations. I think that there's a sort of very base kind of Gladys Kravitz, nosy neighbour interest, not just in what interests us, but in what the neighbours are doing.
There's a fundamental, I think, human curiosity about how other people live and what sort of decisions that they make about their lives, like the sort of spaces they want to live in, the sort of food they like to cook and eat. And I think that also carries over to the other great reality TV edition, which is the dating shows and the romance shows, because it's about what do people say to each other on a first date? Like, what line does this guy think is going to attract that woman to him? You know, what disclosure of his personal habits is he trying to prevent her from seeing or share with her to see how she'll react? It gives us an opportunity to peek into parts of other people's lives and see the sorts of decisions they make about, you know, the kind of ideal lounge room they'd like, but also in the shows where people are competing in pairs, you get to see relationships at work. MasterChef is different because people compete solo. But when you're looking at things like The Block or My Kitchen Rules, it's about the tension in the relationships as well. How do these people get on? How do they work together as a team? What happens when they have a disagreement? You know, and that's all really fascinating because it's a side of people's lives that is often shielded, understandably, except when they volunteer or sign up to go on a reality TV show, we get to see all that. We get to see how they talk to each other, how they dress for a date, what sort of thing, bathroom fittings they think are fabulous. And you can sit at home and either go, oh, aren't they wonderful? Or, oh my goodness, really? It can bring out that judgment in all of us as viewers that either we aspire to what they're doing or we get to sit back and feel very comfortable that we're not in the firing line.
I think that's one of the theories why Tiger King was so popular as well, that people are watching other people's bad decisions and make them feel better about their own good decisions of sitting at home on their sofa and doing the right thing. But with the reality shows, though, there's a lot of accusations that go on now that people are never happy with how they're edited, like in the final cut with what appears on TV. I mean, do you think someone has to be fairly naive to sign up these days to go on one? Because it's always the people who end up on, Married at First Sight or things like that, and they say, but that's not really how I am.
In television, reality television, like Married at First Sight or The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, the genre is called soft script. And it's called soft script because Neighbours and Home and Away have what's called a hard script, which is an actual set of lines that actors walk into the frame and speak. And on a soft script show, there's no written dialogue, but the story touch points and the turning points and the twists and the, oh, she ruined my dinner party, that's all pre-programmed. And those participants agree to play it and they agree to play the tension. And in fact, in real life, they may well get on incredibly well, but in truth, they've become the new, you know, JR and Bobby or the new Alexis and Crystal of the show that they're in. They've created these sort of fictional rivalries. There's no clear blueprint, I guess, is the best way to put it, because I think some shows clearly are more softly scripted than others. MasterChef doesn't have anything like that. Married at First Sight does. On a show like The Block, where you're watching a competition drive the story and you're drilling into the tension of a relationship, you are getting probably glimpses of truth. You're getting these glimpses of how these people live and who they are. And you do probably see the fairest window into their character in lots of ways. On a show like The Real Housewives that sort of sits in a certain part of this genre, it's as much a concoction as it is a performance. So in a sense, it feels real because it sells you the fantasy that you want to believe. It's giving you the sort of the quote truth unquote that you think belongs in the story, that these women are rich and nasty and they all hate each other. But actually, it's you might as well be watching a pantomime or a kind of a low rent production, because inevitably that's probably what you're seeing to some extent.
But also, I think in the question of the editing and the participants feeling that they're hard done by, I think people sign up for reality shows now thinking they know what they're in for. And they also go in thinking maybe they're going to be one of the stars of the season. But in terms of the editing and the production, they're pawns on a chessboard. The people who produce these shows are trying to create really good stories. They want conflict, they want cliffhangers, they want tension, they might want romance, but really there is a fundamental difference between what the contestants and participants are after and what the producers and editors are after. And if they're lucky, they will come out of it well, but basically they're going to be manipulated to create the best stories for that season. And if it's decided that they're very unguarded and they're very forceful and they're very forthcoming, there's a good chance they're going to end up as villains. And basically, introverts aren't casted for these shows anyway.
No.
I think also in that space, in that sort of nexus of kind of discomfort, that's actually really where the best moments, I think, of these shows live. I think that that contestant, the kind of cocky, I've watched six seasons and I'm going to game the game. I know how to play it. Those moments when they explode, you know, this is where the genre lives. The Big Brother eviction show where Merlin kind of taped his mouth closed in protest over refugees and Gretel Colleen, to her enormous credit, I mean, it was an incredible piece of television. She stayed with it. She played it. It was, the rule book was tossed out the window. Those moments where I think the game breaks or comes close to breaking, in the end, the game never really breaks. I mean, that was simply became maybe the best episode of Big Brother in the history of Big Brother. But what's incredible about them is that watching the framework splinter around the moment, watching the contestant who was trying to game the moment, watching the show try to wrestle back control of the moment, the greatest moments of reality television are not moments that are kind of soft scripted or planned or prepared. They're the moments where the game breaks or comes close to breaking, I think, and everybody's suddenly in the wilderness and nobody knows what to do. There's majesty in that for television. That's where all the magic lives.
Debbie and Michael, if you had to choose a reality show to appear on, which one would you pick?
Oh, my goodness.
My cooking's diabolical, so I have to rule out. I've only got four things. I have to rule out MasterChef. They're great things. They're family recipes, but it's a really limited repertoire. And no one wants to hear the grandmother story four times in the main show. So I'm not sure I could cope on any of them.
Really? Debbie, what are you in?
Yeah, look, sorry, I have to kind of reject the question too. I can't imagine. I cannot imagine would motivate anybody to sign up for these, because I think you just surrender so much of your own control over your life. I mean, even if I was, you know, desperately looking for a soulmate, I would look at Married at First Sight after what, seven seasons, and think, you know what, even with all that expert advice, their track record isn't that great.
It's terrible. It's the best ad for being single.
I think I'd be better off online on Tinder than trusting the experts on Married at First Sight.
All right, let's move on to safer ground. We're heading into game time. This week, we are back to Mastermind. We have Debbie as our challenger. So Debbie's subject of choice this week is Frasier. Right. Debbie, are you ready?
Well, I guess I'm entering the arena with nothing to lose as the challenger, no. So I'm pretty happy about that.
You're like Poe. You are playing to win. Right, here we go. A spin-off of Cheers, Frasier is a comedy series following the story of psychiatrist Frasier Crane, played by Kelsey Grammer, as he returns to his hometown of Seattle. Now, Frasier Crane is a radio psychiatrist, but what kind of psychiatry does he practice?
No idea. Relationships?
It's named after a very famous psychiatrist. I don't know if you want to.
Freudian.
Yes.
Thank you for the clue.
Very good. So that's one. Daphne is a live-in housekeeper hired by Frasier to help Martin with his physiotherapy. Where is she originally from?
Manchester.
Yes. Very good.
Oh, thank goodness.
Question three. How did Frasier sign off on his radio show?
Frasier Crane. Good mental health.
Yes. Yes. Very good.
Thank you.
Very good. That's it. You've done it. That was a hard one. How many times has Niles, who is Frasier's brother, been married during the series?
Three.
Yes.
Good.
Yes. First to his wife Maris Crane, who we never see but always hear about, followed by a short marriage to Melinda Karnofsky, and ending, of course, with Daphne Moon.
Maris, one of the greatest characters never seen on television.
<I know. laughs> Okay. Frasier hosts the Dr. Frasier Crane Show, a call-in psychiatry show on talk radio station KACL. What does KACL stand for?
Absolutely no idea.
This is a real insider one. Okay. The radio station is named after the three executive producers of Frasier, David Angell, Peter Casey, and David Lee. And the K is a prefix for almost all US radio stations west of the Mississippi River.
I'm really sorry I didn't know the answer, but that's a really great question.
Debbie, that is 4 out of 5. Well done.
Thank you. Yes. I'm shocked, but good.
Okay. Defending champion.
I have no hope. Here it goes.
Oh, okay. Defending champion Michael into the ring, please. Okay. Your special subject for today is Star Trek.
The original series.
Star Trek is a science fiction television series following Captain James T. Kirk and the crew of the USS Enterprise as they explore the galaxy and defend the United Federation of Planets. The series is set in the Milky Way galaxy in what century?
Oh, that's easy. The 23rd century.
Yes, very good.
Yes, I do know that.
There we go. See, not a struggle. Yeah. What does the T in James T. Kirk stand for?
Okay, we're going to have to toughen up this competition. The T stands for Tiberius.
Yes, very good. Well done. So now you have to finish William Shatner's voiceover introduction during each episode's opening, so which states the starship's purpose. Okay, so it starts off with space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. What comes next?
Her five-year mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life forms and new civilizations, and to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Oh, big claps.
Whoa.
Big claps. Yes. Well done. Okay. What was the title of the unaired pilot episode?
Okay. The Cage.
Oh, God, Michael.
And actually, it didn't have Captain Kirk in it, by the way, The Cage. The Cage was under, the Enterprise was under the command of Captain Christopher Pike, who was the captain before Captain Kirk. Okay. Who knew there was one? Who knew there was one?
All right, this is your last question. What was the name of the blood fever which killed the Vulcans if they didn't mate once every 7 years?
7 years. Oh, God. Okay, it's called Ponfar.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's 5 out of 5. Look, here's a little interesting thing about Ponfar, because it is every 7 years the Vulcan males and females become aroused, which kind of is slightly disturbing to think about. But if they do not mate with someone, they eventually enter Plak Tau, and a blood fever and become violent and die. There we go. We've all learnt something. Wonderful. For our back catalogue show today, we're returning to 1992 and the airing of Australia's first reality show, Sylvania Waters. A co-production between the BBC and the ABC, the 12-part docu-soap followed the nouveau riche Donaher Baker family, the hard-living Nolene, her rev-head partner Laurie, and their blended family. Nolene's two sons, Paul and Michael, and Laurie's son Mick, plus a daughter-in-law, de factos, grandchildren, and their neighbour Pat. They drank, they argued, they sent our cultural cringe into overdrive, with the ABC copying a deluge of complaints when it aired. Director Tom Watson said he just wanted to show a typical Aussie family. Nolene called it a stitch-up, and when it first screened in Britain, the Sun newspaper introduced it as, "Meet Nolene, by tonight you'll hate her too." You can now find the whole series in all its messy glory on YouTube. So before we go to you, Michael and Debbie, let's take a listen to this clip, which features narration by Nolene's younger son, Michael, and Nolene and Laurie doing what they do best, talking about themselves and being wildly inappropriate.
You're going to see me as I am, as me. I'm me. I can't be nice and I can't be Joan Collins. I'm me. I'm me.
Then there's Laurie. He's my stepfather, but Mum and him aren't married yet. He's also really interested in car racing.
Driving a racing car, 10 tenths is like going to bed with a good woman. Very exciting. Very exciting. Very exciting. When you get out of it, you think, Jesus, I've got to do that again.
Debbie, do you remember the first time you saw Sylvania Waters?
I did, and I remember vividly when it arrived on Australian TV screens and the kind of mix of outrage and shock that came with it to see a family in such an unvarnished way. I mean, they appeared right from the beginning to have no filters. I think it starts with an argument. I mean, you come into that kitchen with them arguing about, you know, whether or not the house is big enough to have Michael's 16th birthday party, and the language is rugged and the tension is high and you're drawn in almost immediately. But I just think what's really interesting in that way, given what we were discussing earlier, contestants now who go into documentary series or reality TV contests think they know what they're in for. Nolene and Laurie and their family wouldn't have had a clue, but it was really compelling stuff, and I think it stands up really well.
Yeah, I mean, director Tom Watson said he just wanted to show a typical Australian family. Michael, were they typical to you?
They were cast by the BBC. So even though we talk about it as a BBC-ABC co-production, the BBC was the dominant partner in it. What you get on arrival is this incredibly messy, jangled sort of show. What matters to the British viewer is that the sun is shining, they own a boat, they live on the water, they're white. I mean, it's everything about this is kind of designed to reinforce this sort of idea. Certainly, I mean, I think Neighbours and Home and Away have made some steps, not as many steps as perhaps they should, in recent years to kind of change how they structure their narrative ethnically. But certainly at the time, that's what those shows were. They were incredibly white, and they offered the British audience a kind of antidote to what was sort of felt to be the all of the fractious, conflicted parts of British society that sort of came from immigration. And I think that even though Australia is a migrant society itself, those shows kind of told a bit of a lie in a way. There was a poll taken at the time, and 85% of people in Australia said that it was not a fair representation of Australia. So the question actually becomes, is Sylvania Waters wrong, or are we actually in denial about who we are, that we are actually, like, we are this kind of angry, sort of racist, nouveau riche society of people? It's a challenging thing. It was an incredible piece of television in that way. And I think that it's sort of, even though it was kind of engineered to kind of feed a sort of a perception in Britain, in truth what it gave Australia was a really challenging mirror up to itself and its own, the kind of the flaws and the problems in our own selves that was quite compelling. I think there's a great benchmark you can always give of a TV show, which is that if the Prime Minister of the day is compelled to speak out against it, and really that's the honour of that is, you know, John Howard, who had a crack at Big Brother. And even though I think Paul Keating kind of talked around Sylvania Waters, but there was a very famous front page, I think, of the Daily Telegraph, where the then Deputy Prime Minister Brian Howe had a direct crack at Nolene, to the point where Nolene wanted an apology. And I mean, I remember I was a young journalist living through this, and I was a television writer on the Sunday Telegraph, so I remember the premiere in a practical sense. I remember going to the launch, and I think even the ABC maybe didn't realise what it had on its hands. I think when it premiered, it sort of exploded in a quite unexpected way. It was certainly one of the first modern media phenomenon type TV shows where almost the media coverage kind of blew out of the show. It was bigger than the show. It was, you know, it was an incredible machine.
Yeah, and what came after it too, because, of course, Kath and Kim hasn't publicly acknowledged, but obviously Kath and Kim and Fountain Lakes is very much based on Sylvania Waters and the castle too, which was the narration of the castle by the younger son, Daryl Kerrigan. It's very similar to Michael's narration of Sylvania Waters, this lovely sort of naive, sweet narration. Mm. But, I mean, Nolene too at the time said she didn't know what she was getting into. Again, she thought she was misrepresented, that they were going to get more money for the show than they did.
There's one other thing I think I would add with this as well, which is it provokes to me the question of how the camera affects the subject in a way. But if you flash back to America in the early 70s, they had a show called An American Family, which was about a family from Santa Barbara called with Bill and Pat Loud, with the parents and their son Lance. So in the course of the show, Bill and Pat split and Lance came out as gay, and they were a big deal in American culture. And I think the question I would ask, both of how An American Family affected the Louds and how Sylvania Waters affected the Baker Donahoes, is did the camera accelerate the breakups? Like how does all this stuff happen in a six-month window of a family's life? Mm. Would they have split up on the same timeline if the camera wasn't in the room? An American Family was the same window. It was about 6 months of life in the Loud family. And basically in the space of that 6 months, the family was wrecked. I mean, the Donahoes were same but different. There were breakups, but there were also marriages, and their world changed in that 6 months. And you kind of go, how does the camera get there for that 6 months, or do we somehow respond to observation?
That question of putting a camera down in front of any situation is a really interesting one. Mm. Because that basically underpins the whole nature of documentary. Because if you put a camera down in front of any situation, does it change just by virtue of the fact that the camera's there? And I think it kind of does, even if you're not in a reality TV situation where they're after certain things to try and keep the plot moving.
Okay, talking about plot points, we're going to move on and see what everyone's been watching this week. Debbie, what's been turning your dial?
I had a look at a four-part drama series on Netflix called Unorthodox, which is based on a memoir of a Jewish woman who was brought up in an ultra-Orthodox branch of the Jewish religion, went into an arranged marriage. Things didn't work out, and so she flees the community and the marriage to start a life in Berlin. And the series takes place in sort of two time frames. You see her within the community and the lead up to the wedding, and then her early married life, and then you see her trying to forge a new life for herself in Berlin. And I thought it was terrific, particularly the insights into the way the Orthodox community operated, the rituals, the rules, the repression. It was fascinating. It's really evocative.
Yeah, I think it's one of Netflix's top 10 shows in Australia at the moment, so everyone's jumping on it. Michael, what are you watching?
I had a bit of a dive in this week to the black and white first season of Lost in Space, which is unlike the later Lost in Space that went full technicolor and camp and lightness of touch. This is much darker, much more science fiction-y. It starts with a beautiful black and white pilot, of which there are two versions that exist. It was shot as was, and then the second pilot added Dr. Smith and the robot. And it's fascinating when you realize it's the same pilot, but they've simply edited it incredibly cleverly to include them in the narrative and use scenes that were shot with the cast in which they didn't appear. But essentially, futuristic colonization program, the Jupiter 2, the Robinson family blown off course and become hopelessly lost in space. That first season, very dark and science fiction-y and lots of kind of proper fun as opposed to silly fun, which is where the show went.
Well, like the rest of the country, I am watching MasterChef, so I know we've already talked about it, so it's nothing new. But the one thing I do watch every night is I'm watching a lot of Seinfeld at the moment because there are double episodes every night on 10 Peach. It's still the show about nothing with Jerry, George, Elaine and Kramer. I don't think it needs that much explanation. But I think I've seen every episode about 100 times. But for me, the challenge is guessing which actual episode it is in the shortest amount of time. So that's my little game I play with myself every night. And it still makes me laugh out loud. I think it's still the humour still sticks for me. I love it. Guys, that's it for us today. Thank you so much for being such a good mastermind sports. Michael, your crown is back after it tilted off last week with your theme tune.
Tilted very wobble. Badly.
Debbie, you'll have to think up another mastermind
better
topic
luck
next time,
I think.
All right, guys, if you like the podcast, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. And please rate and review us. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael Odato. Debbie is at Debienka, and you can find me at Lou_Ruge. You can also read stories by Michael, Debbie or myself on the mastheads of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We'll catch up with you next time on The Televisionaries. The Televisionaries is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's hosted by myself, Louise Rugenike. It was created and executively produced by Life Editor Monique Farmer and Culture Editor Matt Burgess. The podcast is produced by LapFan and our Head of Audio is Tom McKendrick. The Nine Network is the owner of this podcast and the streaming service Stan.